actually Isaiah chapter 22 today. This is just a little chart. I'm sorry I didn't get it in color and all nice for you, but it may help you as we go through Isaiah. Because, you know, when and I'm giving you these dates, and we're talking about who the king was, and you got Assyria, and you've got Babylon, and when did all this happen, especially when we looked at chapter, I guess it was chapter 21, I think. And you can see Assyria seems to be dominant over Babylon, but then things are going to change and all of that. So I think this will help. It helps me just get a general picture. Maybe you got a question about the dating or the time or the chronology and how all that works, and that ends up being pretty important in Isaiah. This will help you. You can just go back to this and kind of use it as a key. You'll notice the dates there. Now, I've got, and the thing I like about this is that it has the prophets put chronologically in the time period they were prophesying in. And that, to me, that's very helpful. For instance, when you read Isaiah versus when you read Micah. And you'll notice on that, Jonah's prophecy was in, you know, 783 to 753 BC. Then you have Amos, then you have Hosea and Micah. You know, when you read through the Old Testament, that may not be the chronology of how the books occur, you see. And so some people get confused by that. It also has the kings who were ruling. You see, and this is just important for our study, Israel fell to Assyria in 722 B.C. Of course, this is all in the divided kingdom. You also have at the top there, by the way, you know, when 2 Chronicles and Kings is covering all of this history. But you'll notice where Isaiah is if you look there at the top, which is our main point of emphasis. You know, he was dealing with this period of time when Assyria was so powerful, especially. Remember I preached about Josiah last Sunday morning. You can see there under the divided kingdom era, his section was much more akin to the Babylonian exile. So you have 641 to 609. You have the fall of Nineveh and Assyria to 612. But then you have Babylon in about 605. And that's when Habakkuk was, that's about the time Habakkuk was writing, actually. So I just thought that would be interesting. You might stick that in your notes. If you throw this away, don't throw it away in front of me. So, okay, let's get into Isaiah chapter 22. We got into the first 14 verses. Now, we covered a lot of ground last week. If you weren't here and you want my notes, if you can read them, you can have them. I'll copy them off. This is the old-fashioned way right now. So, but if you want those notes, and I think we have it recorded. Don't we, Frank? It's back there. So if you want the CD, you weren't here, just want to catch up in class, we'll be happy to give that to you. Okay. As we got into chapter 22, and of course, just to kind of review a little bit here, we're dealing with, again, God pouring His judgment out on the nations. The remnant of Israel, those who would be faithful to God, will be preserved. God's will is that they be punished, and that they submit to His purpose in that regard, rather than fight against it from a military standpoint. And what we've learned so far is all of those alliances they might try to make, whether it was with Egypt or somebody else, to get out of God's judgment on them was actually more rebellion on their part, and it wasn't going to work anyway. We got into Isaiah chapter 22, which often is called the Valley of Decision because of a verse that mentions that phrase. We notice the first 14 verses here. Really, this is divided into about three sections, all very similar. He deals with Jerusalem in the first 14 verses there. That's what we tried to cover last week. We're going to pick up with verses 15 through 19. Someone by the name of Shebna and just his unconcern. It's kind of interesting how he's used as a representation of the people in general. That's important for you to get. You think, why is he talking about this man in Isaiah chapter 22? Because he's using him and his unconcern for God's will and God's truth and the problem with God's people. His attitude depicts really the attitude of the people at large. And so that's why he even comes up in Isaiah chapter 22 in my mind. And then he's going to talk a little bit about what happens to him because of his pride, which is also representative of God's people's pride or any nation's pride that exalts itself against God. Okay, so we'll see that in chapter 22, verses 20 through 25. Right, I'm just seeing if I've missed anything. There was a good quotation that I had from Edward J. Young, who's really good in the prophets, his Old Testament commentaries. He says basically what we get out of chapter 22 and verses 12 through 14, when he says, "Therefore, in that day the Lord God of hosts called you to weeping, to wailing, to shaving the head, and to wearing the sackcloth. Instead, there is gaiety and gladness, killing of cattle and slaughtering of sheep, eating of meat and drinking of wine. Let us eat and drink, for tomorrow we may die. But the Lord of hosts revealed himself to me. Surely this iniquity shall not be forgiven you until you die, says the Lord God of hosts." Edward J. Young, in his quotation on summarizing this verse, says he's pronouncing a sure doom, a sinning, unconcerned, reveling people, a faithful servant. This is the picture of the first 14 verses of the chapter of the present. And so when you look at those first 14 verses there, it's just more of the same in God pronouncing judgment. Does anybody have a question or comment or anything like that before we get into verse 15? Go ahead. We're going to talk about that. Did you find something unique, Daryl, in your study? Okay. I'll tell you what I think, and if I'm wrong, I'm surely going to be exposed for it this morning, and you guys will know better. But Hilkiah is another one. We'll get into Hilkiah, which I think is Eliakim's father. There's a couple of Hilkiahs talked about in the Bible, so you got to be careful as you kind of maneuver. He asked about Shebna, if I'm saying that right, which we're going to talk about in a minute, who he was and why that was important. Okay, let's read verses 15 through 19. Verses 15 through 19. Who'd like to read this morning? Carl Hunt, do you mind reading? Yeah, Isaiah 22, verses 15 through 19. Okay, very good. Again, just remember that the message concerning Shebna may be considered a continuation of the oracle against Jerusalem. Brother Homer Haley, in speaking about why Shebna even comes up, and I'm quoting him, says, "He exemplifies the fleshly spirit of the period, luxury, ostentation, and the desire for personal glory. Although he was a historical character, he also personifies the general spirit of the political ambitions of the time." From what I have found, Shebna held an important position as a manager of Hezekiah's household. You can read about that in 2 Kings chapter 18 and verse 18. Now, by the time you're reading about him there, he doesn't seem to be complete ruler of the household, but certainly an important position. We'll talk about why that is, which is even in this section. We know he was sent as an envoy of the king to negotiate with the Assyrian general in 2 Kings chapter 18, verses 18 through 37. In chapter 22 and verse 15, you'll notice there he says, Thus says the Lord God of hosts, come go to this steward, to Shebna, who is in charge of the royal household. And then he says in verse 16, what right do you have here and whom do you have here that you have hewn a tomb for yourself here? We'll talk about why he speaks of this. You who hew a tomb on the height, you who carve a resting place for yourself in the rock. And the emphasis is on yourself, your concern for yourself. We know that he seems from this section of Scripture to have been more concerned about his tomb, about his resting place, about where he would be put when he died, than he was the fact that we have this tragic judgment being poured out on God's people very soon. Okay, so the point here is he was self-absorbed, he was selfish, he was more concerned about himself than he was God's people. Okay, now, as we progress along here, look at chapter 22, verses 17 through 19. Would Shebna end up having the burial that he thought he wanted? No. No, he would not. What was going to happen? So, you're all, you know, you're not seeing, and this is, to me, this is the point in the text. Here is this huge moral, ethical, spiritual sickness, as Isaiah described it. If you look at Isaiah chapter 1, when he talks about, you know, basically from the top of the head to the bottom of the body, they're just spiritually in a bad place. Okay. And rather than being concerned about that, rather than listening to God's spokesman, he's just concerned about himself. And God's going to pour judgment out. But the thing about Shebna is, for all of his selfishness, for all of his self-concern, he wasn't going to fulfill what he wanted. And so in verses, if you look at verses 17 through 19, behold, the Lord's about to hurl you headlong, O man, and he is about to grasp you firmly and roll you tightly like a ball to be cast into a vast country, and there you will die, and there your splendid chariots will be, your shame of your master's house. I will depose you from your office, and I will pull you down from your station. So, here's again the point. That's the same, what you see in personified in Shebna is the same thing Isaiah's been trying to get the people of God to see from the very beginning. And so he's going to end up dying in disgrace. From the commentators that I have read, when you go over there to some of the Second Kings, and I'll get to this more, but there's certain people that seem, other than in this passage regarding Shebna, he's always mentioned with Joah, who was the son of the recorder Asaph, Eliakim. Eliakim, he's deposed. Shebna is demoted. Okay? Eliakim is going to be put in the place of authority, and that's what you're going to find from verses 20 through 25 in this section. Why? He mentions Eliakim's faithfulness in contrast to Shebna's self-promotion. Okay? He's just promoting self. God doesn't see him as being faithful, so he's not going to get what he wants. Eliakim is going to bring stability to some degree, but even Eliakim's not going to be there forever. Go ahead, Roger. That's a good question. That's a good question. I haven't seen anything. That could be an implication or a thought anyway. If he's that concerned about himself and he has this position where he has access to funds, for instance, is there a possibility that maybe that's why God felt the way he did about what he was doing? That's a good thought. Okay, so we have verses 20 through 25 now. So we know Shebna, if you look, he says in verse 19, I will depose you from your office, and I will put you down from your station. So he's going to get demoted. In verse 20, then it will come about in that day, which is just the pouring out of God's judgment, that I will summon my servant Eliakim, the son of Hilkiah, and I will clothe him with your tunic and tie your sash securely about him, and I will entrust him with your authority, and he will become a father to the inhabitants of Jerusalem and to the house of Judah. And then I will set the key of the house of David on his shoulder, and when he opens, no one will shut, and when he shuts, no one will open. By the way, that phrase, this is interesting. That phrase, does that make you think of any New Testament passages? Can you think of which one? About no door being able to shut. What'd you say, Mike? Yeah, that's true. Yeah, the all authority. And in connection with it being about Christ, where can you think of anywhere there is a, it's in Revelation. What'd you say? Yes. Yes. It's, and I believe that's talking about the church at Philadelphia, isn't it? Where he's talking about the fact that providentially, you know, they seem to be in a very blessed area and he was going to open up a door that no man can shut. And that language, if you'll think about the original text, it kind of may add some things to your appreciation that in the case of Eliakim, you have in Eliakim God putting Eliakim into an authoritative position because he was found faithful. When you go to Revelation, in a permanent sense, you have the exaltation of Christ as Messiah and his authority as head of the church, and the fact that he was going to provide an opportunity with them. You might just do some reading on that, but think about it in light of Isaiah, because it seems to me that's being cited there. But if you look there in verse 22, interestingly, he says, I will set the key of the house of David on his shoulder, and when he opens, no one will shut, and when he shuts, no one will open, and I will drive him like a peg in a firm place, and he will become a throne of glory to his father's house. So let's talk a little bit about that. Eliakim becomes a royal officer. He portrays faithfulness to the Lord and King. Other than verse 20, Eliakim is always mentioned with Shebna and Joah and with the son of a recorder Asaph. Eliakim is the polarized opposite to Shebna, not self-promoting, according to verses 20 and 21. Isaiah was prophesying that Shebna would be demoted, that Eliakim would replace him. And so again, what is all this for? This is representative of what's going on with God's people. They had been lifted up with pride. They needed to be more like Eliakim than they were Shebna. And I think that's the point that we get here. And Eliakim, if you look at verses 22 and 23, as we mentioned, will be able to make conclusive decisions and would offer a stabilizing influence in the kingdom. Okay. Anybody have a question on that? That's the best I can do. You mean about Eliakim being found faithful and all that? Yeah, I think it may be subtle, but I think certainly, especially, that's what I was trying to say before, especially when you look at that kind of language, the Holy Spirit's pulling on that language and applying it to Christ. There's a lot of differences, obviously, but that's always the case when you look at types and antitypes and all of that. It's just always going to be the case. You can't over-literalize every detail. But it does seem to me that with Eliakim, God found him faithful. He wasn't selfish or self-consumed. He was given this authority. Obviously, with Christ, you're dealing with one who was divine. Eliakim wasn't. You deal with one's reign who will be forever. Eliakim's wasn't. Even though, when I say reign, you know what I mean, position of authority. So he says, he'll be like a peg. If you look there, look at verse 13, or 23, excuse me. I will drive him like a peg in a firm place, and he will become a throne of glory to his father's house. But look at verse 24. So they will hang on him all the glory of his father's house, offspring and issue, all the least of vessels, from bowls to all the jars. In that day, declares the Lord of hosts, the peg driven in a firm place will do what? Will give way. So he's going to give way too. and it will even break off and fall, and the load hanging on it will be cut off, for the Lord has spoken. But God just wasn't going to give Shebna his way on this one. So, because of his unfaithfulness. All right. Anybody got anything? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Uh-huh. I think so. Because when you go back and read, let me see, and that may be the text I'm thinking of, Ronnie. Give me just a minute. Okay, when you go back to 2 Kings 18, it seems to me the demotion has already happened, because you're reading about Eliakim, I believe, being the one in the place that Isaiah seems to be saying Shebna was before he was demoted. So I think most Bible students would conclude from that's a record of him post-demotion. That's just what I found. Did you find anything else, Daryl, that you want? That's right. His prime minister? Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, if you're so selfish that you can't even think about a nation, your own people, but people in crisis before God, and you have access to money, going back to Roger's point, the Bible doesn't say this, I'm just saying by implication you might conclude that if he's unfaithful in those other ways, I would venture to say, from knowing people and how they are and what Jesus said about being faithful in a few things, he probably wasn't just exactly the most faithful person in other regards either. Because that gets to be a character issue. And character issues tend to not just be in one area. You may only know about one area, but character impedes everything we do and every relationship we have, and affects us in a lot of different ways. And that seems to be the case with Shebna. Okay. Did you, Ricky, go ahead. Yeah. What does yours say? What does it say? Yeah. Yeah, I guess when I read, let's see. In that day, declares the Lord of hosts, the peg driven in a firm place will, yeah, I see what you say. It will even break off and fall, and the load hanging on it be cut off. So there you go, for the Lord has spoken. So to me, it's kind of like God removes his desire for it to sustain itself, and in a sense, he's cutting it off. But I think toward Israel. That'd just be, you know, Eliakim went with it. Okay. Anybody? Anything else? All right, chapter 23. Tyre. We hear a lot about them in the Bible, among the prophets. Tyre was the chief city, the state of Phoenicia. It was 35 miles north of Mount Carmel. The Phoenicians were the preeminent, by the way, seafarers of antiquity. They colonized the whole Mediterranean basin, including Carthage in North Africa and Tarshish in Spain. Both David and Solomon had pretty good dealings with them, with Hiram, king of Tyre. If you read 1 Kings, I think it is, 5:1. He actually cooperated with Solomon by providing cedar and cypress timber to build his palace and the temple. The Phoenicians also, though, had a corrupting influence on the people of God just by way of idolatry. Solomon took some Phoenician wives. That got him into a lot of trouble, of course. Do you know anybody else that would have been from that area that is an infamous woman in the Old Testament? That very idolatrous. The place where she was from would be within what we would consider Phoenicia. Jezebel. Yeah, Jezebel came from that area. So, very idolatrous, very paganistic. And so while in some ways historically maybe not as hostile quite, you know, at certain periods of time, certainly there's some history there. Now, the oracle against Tyre was likely placed here, I think, to bracket the series of oracles. But like Babylon in the east, Tyre in the west summed up all the world thought to be significant. I mean, we would think of power and prestige and authority and wealth. But what usually comes with power that can lead to downfall? What? Corruption, pride. Pride usually leads to the corruption. They were very proud. Other prophets prophesied. Isaiah prophesies of their downfall, but so does Jeremiah in Jeremiah 47 and verse 4. Ezekiel in Ezekiel 26:4. Zechariah in chapter 9, very messianic book. Zechariah chapter 9 verses 3 and 4. And so now God is pronouncing His judgment. There's plenty of idolatry here. It seems to go around among these nations. Plenty of corruption and immorality. And God's pouring His judgment out on them. Let's read chapter 23, verses 1 through 7. And this is the initial mourning over Tyre's downfall and God's judgment. And let me say this before we read this. Some of these prophecies will speak as though something has happened, even though it hasn't happened yet, because the prophet is certain it will happen. So just, you gotta kind of read that and watch out for that. Chapter 23, verses 1 through 7. Who would like to, Bo? If you would. Okay, so we have these ships of Tarshish, as I mentioned to you, largest trading vessels of antiquity. So what would that mean for other peoples? Do other peoples benefit from Tyre? If they've got these huge ships, what might they be bringing to those other people? Everything in the world, food. Okay, grain. With Egypt got grain from these ships. So, you know, we talk about today the world economy and that kind of thing. During this time, if Tyre goes down, if their economy, you know, this is a perfect example, when you have trade going on among countries and you've got the beneficiary and you've got the supplier, and the supplier gets into trouble, it's not just the supplier that's going to suffer. Okay, so what he's saying, Isaiah's saying, God's pouring judgment on a lot of folks. And he knows where to go to get the supplier here. And when you look at chapter 23, he seems to be mentioning that. Now, the city came under attack several times from the 7th century B.C. onward. It's a little hard to know, is there one attack or is this, you know, is this prophesying about several attacks, successive attacks? But Alex, we do know Alexander the Great attacked and accomplished his final destruction and overtook that area. Now when you look at chapter 23 verses 2 through 6, again going back to what I was saying, the destruction of Tyre and her navy would have disastrous effects on the whole economy of the Mediterranean basin. As I mentioned to you, Egypt depended on her for grain. And if you look at verse after all of this, look there at verse 4. Be ashamed, O Sidon, for the sea speaks, the stronghold of the sea, saying, I have neither travailed nor given birth. I have neither brought up young men nor reared virgins. When the report reaches Egypt, they will be in anguish at the report of Tyre. You see that verse? It's easy to read over that. That verse is telling you what's going on. It's not going to be good for anybody involved in this situation. And then in verse 6, he says, pass over to Tarshish, well, O inhabitants of the coastland. And then he says in verse 7, and we might ask, why is verse 7 there? Is this your jubilant city whose origin is from antiquity, whose feet used to carry her to colonize, I'm reading from the New American Standard Bible, to colonize distant places? What's verse 7 saying? Because you almost can pick up on the tone, and the tone helps appreciate, if you can figure out by the words, the tone. What do you think he's saying? He's told you all this is going to happen. But in verse 7, what is he saying? When he says, is this the jubilant city whose origin is from antiquity, whose feet used to carry her to colonize distant places? What do you think he's... A little bit. What were you going to say? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think in verse, that's right, but in verse 7, when I read from the New American Standard Bible, it says, is this, get the sarcasm. I mean, sarcasm can have a place. The Lord used it in spite of what some may think on occasion. Paul certainly did. And I don't mean that in the way we think of sarcasm. I mean more in an intellectual way. When you look at verse 7, I think what he's saying is, so you were so proud of yourself. You thought this could never happen to you. You thought you would always be as prosperous and powerful as you had been. And I think what he's saying is, the reason this has occurred is because of me. The Lord is saying that. Because I'm bringing judgment on you. And so, basically, it would be like saying, where's the jubilant city now? Now, where are you now that I've poured on judgment? For all of your pride and all of your arrogance and all of your conceit and feeling of superiority, where are you now? I think that's probably how we would say it. And so in verse 7, is this your jubilant city whose origin is from antiquity? Do you think because this is an old city it would always be here? Whose feet used to carry her to colonize distant places? In other words, you used to go colonize and now you're being overtaken. And so that's his point. And if I were going to make a more modern kind of application from a personal standpoint, it's just what Paul said when he said, take heed lest you fall. We could make a lot of applications of this, excuse me, to individuals, to churches. I know congregations that have thought, well, we've been here for this long, you know, this many years. Well, that doesn't mean you'll always be there. It doesn't mean you're in a situation where you can't die. If you don't serve the Lord and you don't remain faithful and you allow worldliness to corrupt the congregation and the assembly. So there's a lot of applications to be made there. But I think that's his point to Tyre, and that is that judgment is real. It's a reality. Here's the deal. When things feel like you're still on top, and when things feel like you're prosperous, and when you still feel you're in a superior position, and the prophet is telling you this is what's going to happen, there's the tendency to just go, nah, that's not going to happen. Because you don't really want to believe it anyway. Who wants to believe something like that? You know, and even individuals, maybe somebody that has wise counsel says, look, I know things seem okay right now, but if you keep making these decisions, there's just going to be this downward spiral and you're going to hit the bottom eventually. And you tell people that. And you're telling them the truth. Morally, they're going down, but it hadn't sunk in yet. It's almost like they have to hit bottom before they realize, ah, that was right. And I think that's what you have here. Tyre is going to come to experience this. And they've been told what they're going to experience. Their pride is just preventing them from really coming back to the true God and giving up idolatry and that kind of thing. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. Right. The figurative, and I want you to listen to me for a minute in the Bible, because some, you know, a lot of people go, why doesn't the Bible just come on out and say whatever it has to say? Well, unfortunately, when it does that, most people don't listen to it, because some of the most controversial issues, the Bible does literally come right on out and say it. However, there are occasions in which figurative language is so rich and there's so many different ways to offer it, it helps really drive the point home. I mean, if you think about Scripture, even Jesus, that's why Jesus used parables. I mean, we talk about it being an earthly story to make a spiritual point, but the reason he used those parables, that's agricultural concepts and building concepts. Paul uses those. He talks about a foundation man building something. Jesus talks about the wise man's house and the foolish man's house. All of our kids have sung those songs, and they get it. I mean, if they're very old at all. And so my point to you is, when you look at the prophets, you see just very vivid, forthright language, but also figures that are trying to get this point across. Oh, yeah, go ahead. That's a good point. That is a good point. I'd forgotten. Yeah. Yeah, you know, that is a good, as bad as Tyre. You read about Tyre and you think, man, they must have been pretty bad. But Jesus did say that. He said if they had all the preaching you've had, they would have repented in sackcloth and ashes, which tells you how bad it was during Jesus' time. Go ahead, Darrell.
An interesting note from 1 Kings 10. This is about 300 years before this. We were talking about what all came through. Tarsus, Tyre, and all that. Solomon had merchant ships that were harbored in Tarsus. Mm-hmm. So the king had merchant ships at sea. The fleet of Hiram, once every 3 years, merchant ships came bringing gold, silver, ivory, apes, and monkeys.
Monkeys?
Yeah. Everything in the world. Uh-huh. And if you had money,
right,
it was there.
Right. That's a good... So, you know, you start thinking of economies. I'm sure those people, you know, there's going to be an ebb and flow, but it's never just going to collapse. And there's a lot of people that thought that, and over and over and over, you can see that historically when it did. Chapter 23, let's look at verses 8 through 12. Who would like to read for me? Jason Blue, can you get it for me? Isaiah 23, just verses 8 through 12. Okay. Now, Ricky, this kind of goes back to what we were talking about. I think the Old King James is very accurate when it gives that impression when we were talking before about God cutting off, because that's what he did. When the New American Standard Bible talks about giving way, the original language indicates that as well. Both are true. And I think what you see here is God, look at what it says there in verse 11, he has stretched his hand out over the sea. He has made the kingdoms tremble. The Lord has given a command concerning Canaan to demolish its strongholds. So it's as if the strength they looked like they had to be able to be prosperous and strong, God had ripped all that away from them. And so now they are weak. It is that they are weak, but it's because, as we were mentioning in the comments Ricky had made, God was bringing His judgments upon them. Okay, and you see that more in verses 8 through 12. But there is the indication that there could be some restoration to follow destruction. Let's read 23. I'll begin here in verse 13. Behold, the land of the Chaldeans, this is the people which was not. Assyria appointed it for desert creatures. They erected their siege towers. They stripped its palaces. They made it ruined. Well, O ships of Tarshish, for your stronghold is destroyed. Now in that day, Tyre will be forgotten for 70 years, like the days of one king. And at the end of 70 years, it will happen to Tyre as in the song of the harlot. Take your harp, walk about the city, O forgotten harlot. Pluck the strings skillfully. Sing many songs that you may be remembered. It will come about at the end of the 70 years that the Lord will visit Tyre. Then she will go back to her harlot's wages and will play the harlot with all the kingdoms on the face of the earth. Her grain and her harlot's wages will be set apart to the Lord. It will not be stored up or hoarded, but her gain will become sufficient food and choice attire for those who dwell in the presence of the Lord. What do you get out of that? Anybody get anything? What is it, Darrell? Right, right. There's some question about the 70 years. Some see it as a figure of time. In other words, not a specific numerical time, but a limited time, and then this is going to happen. Seven, if you've studied Revelation before, you know, 7 and 10 and all that kind of stuff. Some actually say that it could have been during the Babylonian rule, 605 to 539 B.C. You know, that was 70 years. So, you know, you can do your study on that. Before we stop, just let me encourage you, please read. It'll be an easier read for you, I think. Depends on your perspective. But chapters 24 through 27, we're going to try to kind of cover a section, because they all, it deals more with just God's judgment, God's deliverance, the song of deliverance. Now, let me just say this for you. Isaiah's going to change a little bit. The closer we get to the end, the more messianic it's going to get. So it'll change. I know you feel like, oh, we're just hopping from, you know, we feel like I'm watching a map and I'm going from one place to the next and God's going to pour judgment out. It's going to change. That's going to continue, but it's going to change and it's going to get a little bit more positive and talk more about the remnant and the messianic time and all of that. So just stay with us and we'll get there together. Thank you.